Joan. Good morning, everyone, to the of the Rising or Risen Sun. Now, why am I hearing myself? Okay, I guess it's okay. With Lynn and Bruce Rawls is here with me on Skype. And good morning, Bruce. How are you this morning?
Good morning, Lynn. And yourself?
I'm wonderful. Very well, in fact, and glad to be up and talking to you this beautiful Saturday morning. Sun's not up yet, but it's getting that way, and right now we're in the same time zone, and how much longer is that going to be? Do you have any new news, or just still waiting?
About a month. Just about a month, yeah.
Wow. So yeah. Christmas, you'll be home for Christmas, sounds like.
Yep. Changing the dream geography again.
Yeah. So. Oh, my goodness, yeah. Oh, well, you know
it'll
what?
Be, it'll be fun. It'll be fun. We're looking forward to it. What's that?
I'm sure you are. I'd be looking forward to it, too, I think. I'd be loving to live near the ocean. You know, it's just not my, not what's happening to me right now. So, I'm just as happy to be living here near the mountains. Always near something beautiful, aren't we?
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Yeah.
It's all a matter of choice, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. You know, well, it's, you know, it's always up to you.
Choice in the mind.
That's right.
Nothing to do with what appears on the screen, huh?
I know, it's so crazy. All right, now, I was thinking that you had sent me a link.
I did. It's in the
okay,
chat
there
window
it,
in
there
Skype.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
If that one
1234. 1234, is that it?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Should we just dive right in? Maybe we can cover a couple of them, because these are both, well, this one's kind of short. But
I'll tell you what, why don't you... start reading. I just heated up my tea in the microwave.
Okay.
I'll run downstairs and grab it. So okay. I'm going to mute my mic and let you start reading.
Okay, sounds great. So what we have been doing for quite some time now is reading from the Frequently Asked Questions from the Foundation for A Course in Miracles. FACIM.org is the website, the overall website. And there's a sub-domain, which is FACIMOutreach.org. That has over 1,300 questions. And I've been just kind of going through these a few at a time, and I've kind of slowed down because I'm busy doing other things. I think they definitely merit going through the entire list of questions in, you know, whatever order. But I've just been doing it in numerical order just so I don't miss any, and because they're all really good. And we've just kind of been inching our way through these over the last few months. And in terms of the ones that we're sharing on Saturday mornings, Lynn and I, and the one that I happen to be on this morning is 1234, 1234, easy number to remember. And it starts with the overall question, could multiple differing accounts of history all be correct? And the question begins, that's sort of the synopsis, the question begins for 1234, in my view, the physical world as illusory can be compared to a novel, which to me means we could speak at least of a relative reality, the content of the novel, the subject studied by scientists, historians, etc. So, for example, there would be a precise sense to any assertion about the, quote, historical Jesus, unquote. I'm disturbed by different accounts about the historical Jesus that contradict each other in the Bible and the Seth books and the Casey readings and the disappearance of the universe, etc. In my opinion, only one of these, if any, can be true in parentheses, in the illusory world. But a remark in chapter 1 of A Vast Illusion by Kenneth Wapnick, where he speaks about, quote, probable realities in this, unquote, in the sense of the Seth books, seems to indicate that this interpretation is wrong, that a better analogy for the physical world would be a whole library of different novels. Does this mean that the contradictory accounts about the historic Jesus could all be true in our illusory universe in some sense? It's kind of an interesting question, isn't it? I mean, sort of a tangent in a sense, but I think it can all lead back to the core curriculum that we're all involved in. So anyway, it seems like a good open-ended question about what we think is real, and particularly the historical aspects of things, you know, what seemed to happen. And if time is an illusion, then, which isn't our experience here, of course, then that means that both the future and the past are mental constructs, and the only thing that's real is the eternal now. But that's generally not our experience. In fact, our egos are we've trained our egos to be so focused on the past and the future that we almost crowd out the now moment. And I think that's where the popularity of authors like Eckhart Tolle, you know, arise, and for good reason, because, you know, the present moment really is the only thing we have access to. And in truth, that's basically saying that's the only real connection to our minds in terms of the illusion of time is the eternal now, which we don't think of it as eternal, do we? Not very often.
No, anyway. No. And it's so interesting, this question, because it really is exactly what I've been looking at lately. And this whole idea that somehow or the other, see, we're confused by form.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're confused because we believe that form, the illusion of form, is our reality. And what makes the illusion of form seem to be real is the illusion of time.
Mm-hmm. Because and space, right?
Yeah, it's because space itself is only possible if there is time.
Right, and vice versa.
And vice versa. They're the same thing. Mm-hmm. So, we're busy trying to forgive the appearance of form, but
right.
You can't forgive the appearance of form without also forgiving the appearance of time. Mm-hmm. So coming to the understanding that time is, it's fluid. And this is my perspective, and let me just explain this really quickly if this makes any sense to you. In fact, I just wrote this to a person on Facebook yesterday who was, questioning some things. The thing that I've been, I've seen, I guess, it just really came to me very, very clearly that what's happening here is that at the moment when we have the tiny man idea and all possibilities, every possibility of everything that could ever be, if it were possible for us to be separate from God, every single one of those possibilities was mapped out. It was made. For lack of a better word, and this is completely inaccurate, was created and at that very moment. And that, so the possibility of Jesus walking on top of the moon, that was created. The possibility that there was a Jesus who was Chinese, that was created. Every possibility of, if I can think of it right now, it was already made. It was made at that moment. Think about this. Anything you can imagine at this moment was that imaginary thought at that very moment. So every possibility was created, and so what we're doing is walking through it, and what is making it appear, all of these possibilities are right now just static. They're like the movies that are in the can. You know, they're like the book that's on the shelf. It's just static. It's just sitting there. And until
corroborates with modern physics, where they talk about collapsing the wave function, which is basically whenever we project, we're basically saying, I would like a reality in quotes, to manifest from the sea of infinite possibilities. And so we literally 10 to the 44th times per second, you know, collapse the wave function to make up a dream world that seems very real and tangible to us. But we're basically just picking and choosing from the, like you say, this vast oceanic set of possibilities and making up a specific illusion to fulfill the specific projections of a specific dream where we're believing that it's possible to have something specific when our real identity is completely abstract and completely unified.
Exactly. And so time is, this is what I wrote, and this, I don't know if this makes any sense. Everything that could possibly occur was invented in that instant and frozen. You know, the book is frozen. It's not changing. The movie that's in the can is frozen. It's not changing. So everything I'm experiencing is a series of static pictures that are made to appear alive through the trick of time. And you can see that just, you know, you've seen these old flip books where you, there's like a different picture on every page. And when you flip the book, it looks like it's animated. It looks like it's in motion. That's time that's been given to those individual pictures. When they're incorporated with time, they appear to move and they appear to be alive. So perception is looking at these static pictures animated by the lamp of time. We are walking through a maze of shadows, picking a path and choosing which to these already existing stories to follow, or which of these already existing stories to follow. As we learn to see that nothing is really happening, we stop believing that any story can be true. We never make up a new story. They are already written. That's important. We never make up a new story. There's no possibility of me to make up any more illusion than I've already made up.
It's already done and over.
Long ago, yeah. So they're already written. I do think we can pick which story to experience, and I've seen that in the course where, you know, Jesus says if you are able to do this, you move into a different storyline. Mm-hmm. That is the storyline that we call the real world, or the storyline that we call the story of forgiveness. We move into that new storyline, which is gentle and it's kind, and, you know, whereas we were experiencing before a story that was maybe chaotic and fearful. So that forgiveness is what brings us into that different storyline. But again, they're all stories. And eventually I will give up wanting to live this false experience and story. And it's always possible to make that choice. And it is inevitable that we will. Mm-hmm. And that is, I'm being patient with myself because I know it's inevitable. I know that there's no chance that I will not experience heaven, that I will not find my own truth, because it's here already. You know,
that's all that exists.
It's all that exists. Yeah.
All that is.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. As you were talking about the choice of which, in a sense of, you know, which director's cut on the DVD is one metaphor I like. Another one that I find helpful is one of Ken's audios, he talks about the labyrinth and the Greek myth of Ariadne and the Minotaur and I guess that Homeric era stuff. Mm-hmm. I'm not a Greek scholar or anything, but I just remember that the story of the labyrinth was that Ariadne was the protagonist in that escaped the Minotaur which was in the maze. You know, this monster that we're afraid of encountering as we go deeper and deeper into this cavernous maze, you know, of the labyrinthine proportions. And that's kind of the whole great metaphor for this whole space-time dream, isn't it? Because we think that we've gone deep into darkness and deep into the pain of the belief in separation. metaphorically, it's like going into a very dark cave, but we've taken with us this, you know, just kind of like if you're a spelunker, you know, you probably have heard of the technique of, you know, taking some twine or a rope or something, and you know, you pull yourself back out after you've gone into the cave, kind of thing. Well, if we follow ego's agenda, that's a dark cord. It's a dark thread that we follow deeper and deeper, and that thread always branches off into all these different options that seem to be, you know, perplexing and confusing and fearful. Very frankly, very fearful. Whereas all we have to do is take that same cord, that same thread, and, you know, turn our hand around and pull ourselves out of the maze, going the other direction with exact same circumstance at any moment. No matter where we are, the thread is exactly perfect for us to see our perspective in things, not from the little s self perspective, but from the vision that we took with us into the dream, which is, you know, that awareness that has stayed with us and will continue to stay with us, as you point out. You know, we don't need to worry; it's already a done deal. But as we, you know, use it in the other direction, which is in the direction of shared interest and kindness and forgiveness and an all-inclusive sense of identity, that gives us the opportunity then to you know, have that thread become a golden thread, and then it becomes brighter and brighter and illuminates the cave or the labyrinth, so to speak, as we pull ourselves out of what we thought we had trapped ourselves into. And then, of course, the bigger trap is, the seemingly bigger trap is that we think that there's other people that are doing it to us. So there's the whole projection thing that, you know, we try to put on a face of innocence and project our guilt outside of ourselves. And that's the shadows cast on the cave. You know, we can get into Plato's allegory there, I suppose. But that, anyway, it's interesting that there's so many metaphors that kind of fit. I particularly like that one for the vast illusion of space-time and the cavernous, seemingly, you know, vast options and choices, that when really it's just one. It's just which direction are we pulling on that cord? Are we going deeper into the belief in separation, or are we using Holy Spirit's illumination to guide us out of that craziness?
Exactly. And it's so simple to do, that it seems like you can't even figure out why would this make sense. You know, how can this terrible, terrible thing be eliminated by just doing this very simple thing? Mm-hmm. But it's because the terrible thing doesn't actually exist, nor does the experience you have after you, when you practice forgiveness. Forgiveness itself is an illusion as well. So it's not like we're moving from illusion into truth. We're actually moving from illusion to illusion, but because at this point we're not capable of really seeing or knowing the truth, because it's like seeing or knowing something in another dimension that we don't have any experience with. But as we practice forgiveness, we begin to have those experiences of that other dimension. That other dimension of experience becomes available to me. And, you know, what is that other dimension of experience? It's a dimension of experience where I can look at what's happening, it appears to be happening in this world, and laugh. You know, and Jesus says that, you know, you're not going to see suffering. You will not see any pain. You will only see joy. You'll only see perfect happiness. Now, does that mean that, you know, when I, you know, practice forgiveness and accept the atonement, that all of a sudden I'm going to, you know, children are going to start starving, or there's not going to be war, or, you know, disease is going to be gone, or any of those things? Death is going to disappear, that my body will not age? Do I think that's going to happen? And, you know, that's not possible, because all of those things I just mentioned are still part of the illusion. So, you know, you're just going to see the illusion in a different way. It doesn't mean that you're not experiencing an illusion as long as you believe that you're living in a body and dreaming of a world. That's just the way it is. But it's going to be a kinder illusion. And the reason it's a kinder illusion is because you can look at it and recognize that it's not really happening. You know that it's not really happening. And therefore, and everyone who appears to be suffering is just this, is me. Everything that appears to be in the world is me, and it's all just a projection of my own thinking. So we've talked about it. Let's see what the people at the foundation have to say about it. And I will start with the first paragraph of the answer. Okay, so from the perspective of A Course in Miracles, perception is always based on whether we are identified in our minds with the Holy Spirit's thought system or the ego's. And this is a quote from text chapter 12. You see what you expect and you expect what you invite. Your perception is the result of your invitation coming to you as you sent for it. Whose manifestations would you see? Of whose presence would you be convinced? For you will believe in what you manifest, and as you look out, so you will see in. So what I see outside is what I'm seeing in. Two ways of looking at the world are in your mind, and your perception will reflect the guidance you have chosen. So that's Ken's whole thing always is, you know, who are you choosing? Mm-hmm. Who are you choosing to see through the spirit? Or are you choosing to see through ego?
Is it a dark thread or a golden thread? It all depends on which teacher, huh?
Exactly. And, you know, it becomes so clear once you get accustomed to making that choice. But if you are not accustomed to making that choice and things just appear to be happening, see, things appear to be happening out of nowhere, you know, these things come up, out of nowhere these thoughts come up. When I recognize that I'm the one who's choosing all those things, you know, I'm choosing to see whatever it is that I'm seeing, then it can change. But it can't change as long as I believe I'm the victim of the attack. I'm the victim of what's appearing. I'm a victim of what seems to be occurring. Then that can never change because I will always be in that place where I believe that I'm helpless. So it says, the ego thought system of separation rests on the reality of sin, guilt, and fear. That's it. As long as I believe that sin, guilt, and fear are real. And at the core of this system are sacrifice, judgment, specialness, and the body. Thus, anyone identified with that thought system would have a need to perceive Jesus or any other symbol of love and enlightenment in those terms in some way. So we're going to see Jesus as we were projecting. That's it. We can't see anything any differently. And the vision, the idea that we have of who Jesus is, what Jesus is in our own mind. It's not even shared. Not everyone believes the same Jesus. And in fact, no one believes the same Jesus. Everyone has a specific, your own personal Jesus. Remember that song?
I guess I must have missed that one.
Well, that's a good song by Depeche Mode. Your own personal Jesus. It's a good song. Big and rocky and lots to dance around to. We used to play it us and our kids would dance around and sing it, and it was great. You're going to perceive anyone identified with whatever thought system is going to perceive Jesus or any other symbol of love and enlightenment in those terms in some way. And many variations and combinations are possible. The whole, and all those variations and combinations have already existed. We didn't invent them right now. They are part of our original Tiny Mad idea. The Holy Spirit's thought system of the atonement, on the other hand, rests on the unreality of sin, guilt, and fear. And at the core of this system are forgiveness, all-inclusive love, shared interest, and the means for returning us to our reality as mind and spirit. Jesus thus would be presented as he is in A Course of Miracles, as a reflection of the pure oneness of love, as selfless, defenseless, with love and compassion for everyone without exception. But as he tells us in the Manual for Teachers, the universal message of love represented by his presence in our dream can come in many thousands of other forms. And that's in the Manual for Teachers, section 1, paragraph 4, sentence 2. So Jesus is himself in the manual is telling us, and in fact, I've found so much enlightenment or understanding from studying the Manual for Teachers that I never really, I always suspected, but never was confirmed until I started reading the manual, and then it really explains everything so clearly to me. So, we all have our own personal Jesus. And I'll see if I can find that song and I'll play it for you after a while.
All right. Yeah. And that's a good reminder that we think that there's, you know, a special personal symbol for us. And that's okay. Because like you pointed out earlier, you know, the illusion of forgiveness is an illusion, which ultimately is discarded. But we need that just in the same sense as that when you get to the opening of the cave, you don't need the thread anymore. The thread, you know, kind of metaphorically becomes our forgiveness classroom as we're pulling ourselves out of the cave and hand over hand reaching back to the light, you know, with really taking the hand of Jesus, you know, metaphorically, we're basically asking for the opportunity to see things differently. We're asking for the option that we left available in our minds to see the dream as a dream and not as reality. And so all the different forms that it may seem to take become less and less important, and we make less and less of a big deal. And I think you probably experienced that too, Lynn, is a situation that may have been a real challenge a few years ago, or certainly a few decades ago, seen in a different light. There may be some initial reaction, but the identity investment and the emotional, psychological investment in making a big deal out of situations that may have been a big deal a few years ago, doesn't seem to be sustained as long at times. Have you noticed that?
Oh, absolutely. I noticed that. In fact, I don't really even have any of that big deal anymore. It's like it has just gone away from me, because every time it starts up, I feel uncomfortable, and it's that same feeling. I get the same feeling every time it starts up. I'm afraid. I have to make a defense. I have to figure out how to. If there's at any point me practicing a conversation, thinking of what I would like to say, planning to respond, any time that those things come up in my mind. It's like I feel this uncomfortable feeling because it is a feeling of needing to try to do something. And, you know, I recognize, not immediately, but almost immediately, most of the time now that, look, I'm planning. I'm trying to figure out a defense. I'm trying to figure out, you know, a way to preserve my little kingdom here. And in order to do that, I have to figure out a way to attack my brother or this thought or this election or this politician or this advocate or whatever. You know, if I'm coming up with responses that are based on somehow or the other trying to make sense out of this world, I'm doing it.
Right.
I mean, and I know I'm doing. I recognize it, and once I recognize I'm doing it, I can stop. But you cannot stop until you know that you're in trouble. You don't know you're in trouble unless you really will to know what's good, what's true and what's not.
Mm-hmm.
So it really does take work, but it also takes paying attention and noticing how you feel. And Jesus, he says that in the Course. How do you know that you're doing this? How do you know that you're doing it right? How do you feel?
Exactly.
Exactly.
That's such an important principle, because I think it's so easy to get, easy in terms of the ego's propaganda anyway, to get off on a quagmire of thinking of well, gee, how do I gauge my progress? Well, you don't have to. All you have to do is just any at any given moment, am I at peace? And if not, we can say, well, I can choose peace instead of this. And that kind of ties into that favorite line of mine in the Manual for Teachers, in the development of trust, where it's the fifth stage that is, Ken Wapnick refers to it as the dark night of the soul, where, you get in these places where you think, oh gosh, am I really, is this really working? Well, each step is, as the end of that paragraph says, this would be hard indeed if each step weren't so heavily reinforced. I'm paraphrasing there, of course. But because we have that feedback at every given moment, if we're not at peace, if we're not completely at peace, we have an opportunity to choose the other teacher. And it's not, it's not a massive array of choices. It's just one choice. It's really that simple. We just have to say, I must have chosen wrongly because I'm not at peace. So I can choose a different teacher and be at peace. And that's pretty simple, isn't it?
It is simple. But boy, there's so many times that I'm just so stubborn. And, so many times that I want to be not at peace. Mm-hmm. I want to be angry. I want to be, it seems crazy, but I do notice it in myself. There's a desire to be obstructive and to be afraid and to think that someone else can harm me. I do that on purpose because I know it's not true and I know it's not possible. And yet, I definitely, I definitely fall into that hole, uh-huh. And what you gonna do? You're gonna look at that. Look, up here I am again, falling in the hole, Jesus. Throw me down the rope. because I'm in deep now. And, he's always there to pull us out.
Right.
Or the inner kindness teacher, whoever you want to call to. My Jesus, my own personal Jesus, as I've said, he's got his own, his own answer to it. And, if I'm willing to listen to his answer and to accept it, then I'm going to go on and be joyful and not be in fear.
Yep.
But anyway, back to the question of Jesus.
actually, when you said, if I can just make a whimsical comment, when you said Jesus has his own, and you paused momentarily, I was thinking, his own fleet of hyperdimensional escape vehicles? I was kind of picturing this sort of sci-fi epic where this awareness that we took with us into the dream, just to have play with it and have a little fun with it, has all these technological gizmologies that can catch us right when we're about to go down a particularly dangerous turn in the labyrinth and say, oh, let's go this way, and give us something to look at, and place a little flickering light that says, go back this turn in the labyrinth, or we can take a hyper jump, hyperdimensional leap through a little wormhole on space-time. And I think that's what quantum forgiveness does, and I think we talked about this either last week or the week before, that a means of collapsing time. And when we have that experience of forgiveness and trust and being willing to suspend our judgments and condemnations because it's not working for us, and experiencing the joy in that. I think that gives us an opportunity to generalize and to see, wow, that worked here. It could work again. I could, you know, pull on that golden thread and keep pulling on it and eventually get to the opening of the cave. And then it'll start getting lighter and lighter as I reach that opening. At which point, you know, the Course tells us God takes the final step. But along the way, we have a lot of opportunities to use, and as that last paragraph says, many thousands of other forms. And every moment of every day, even if we appear as in Gary Renard's work, you know, to be forgiving the same thing over and over again, each time we're whittling away at the investment in our identity in a thought system and a belief structure that doesn't make any sense. And so it's kind of like, you know, our inner kindness teacher, aka Jesus, aka the Holy Spirit, has, you know, all these counter, technologies to, not necessarily combat, but to transcend the ego's, inappropriate use of the space-time specifics. But we have the opportunity to use those specifics and the technologies in our mind, if you will, of that quantum forgiveness to turn it around. In each case, we can ask for guidance and discover that there is another way of looking at everything. And even all the specifics, we can take any specific thing that we're either upset about or discouraged by or fearful of or whatever the emotion might be that isn't peace, and say, I could choose peace, and, like, you know, I could see peace instead of this. So that's kind of neat, isn't it?
It is. It's such a gift. And, I mean, I know when I first heard it and people would say that, I would say, oh yeah, so easy for you, you know, oh yeah, so simple for you. But, you know, then actually it started happening to me, and I started having the experience, and then I wasn't so smug about it. You know, I actually was like, oh my God, you know, not only, you know, can this happen, it does happen. And it's an amazing gift to once you see the house collapse one time, even. Then you know it can do it again. And unless you really are good at hiding it from yourself, you're always going to have that answer in front of you. So, it's a gift. So, you want to go ahead and read the next paragraph?
Sure. Your commentary triggered a couple of things. One of which was, when you said the house collapse, I was picturing a favorite Monty Python skit where it's, I think it's El Magnifico and Janet, something like that, and it's a magician who basically goes into goes into the minds of the tenants in this alleged housing building, a high-rise building of flats, you know, is and whenever the
Not
tenants stop believing,
right?
No, that's a different one, different episode. But in this one, they found that it was far cheaper to hire a hypnotist than to actually do the construction. And, you know, they saved millions of pounds or something like that. I forget how the skit goes exactly, but, you know, it was this booming business that this hypnotist has because he just goes around, and when the tenants stop believing that they're living in this high rise, facility, he has to go and re-hypnotize them, because then it shows the building wavering, you know, like they're on the 12th floor or something like that. And then you can see that, you know, the camera, they tilt the camera to make it look like the building is starting to shake, you know, but that was when their belief starts to weaken. So they have to bring in the hypnotist to hypnotize them again, to make them believe that they're really in this luxury apartment complex. But I thought, what a great metaphor, because that's really, you know, when we start to question the reality of ego's curriculum, and it's kind of like, you know,
El Magnifico.
Yeah, it's kind of like, you know, needing to bring in a hypnotist, you know, and it takes constant reinforcement. In fact, you know, physicists might suggest it's 10 to the 44th times per second that we hypnotize ourselves to believe that this massive hologram is our reality, this space-time dream. And so what we're given is a very gentle, slow curriculum that helps us undo that insane belief. But we certainly don't think of it that way initially, is in a way that basically gives us a very peaceful transition, a gradual transition that allows us to see that the world that we made up as we intended it as separate ego selves is a fearful, guilty, scary, unpleasant place. But it's only a place in the mind that we thought we had to go to escape from the vengeance of a God that never noticed that we've made up a dream. So that's not too bad when we really see it in that light. But I like the high rise, hypnosis metaphor, because I think it's kind of a fun one. I'll have to post the clip of that on the.
Well, and we do, I think in a lot of ways we do many things to keep that hypnosis going.
Oh, absolutely.
There's so many things that we do to keep that illusion going.
Oh,
and
yeah.
When something is discordant with our point, our view in the illusion, we become, that cognitive dissonance comes up and we either have to run away or face it. And I think for the most part, people just want to run away. They don't want to see, they're not willing to see what they denied because it was the truth,
right?
As the last unanswered question asks us.
Right. Well, even on the level of form, even within, this whole space-time dream drama, just look at our whole political system. And obviously we're getting a front row seat, in this country this next week or two, and have for the last year and a half with all the, the crazy shenanigans of the whole political election cycle. But I just happened to be watching a very quick little video this morning, and I had the sound off, so I was just watching. And I haven't verified these statistics, but it had said something to the effect of, I think it was 1.3 million people have been killed as a result of U.S. Bombings and invasions since 9/11, and we're currently bombing seven countries, counting the drone strikes and all that kind of stuff, and just these statistics that are just like, wow, how crazy is that? But we're not only individually but collectively on a level of denial that's so vast that we don't want to look at the insanity and the horrific quality of, the murderous nature of our egos. And that doesn't mean that we need to be panicky, but just to be able to look, watch our mind and see how we can drain the swamp of our mind by just looking without condemnation, to see every brother as sinless and to see the insanity of everyone's ego individually and then collectively, how, these atrocities are, appear to happen within our dream history, as this FAQ addresses. But we all see it differently, don't we? I mean, we all have different perceptions depending on what we've chosen to look at. But that doesn't mean that the dream is real. It just means that we have different things to bring to our forgiveness classroom. But it's the same classroom. It's the same classroom, but with different forms, isn't it?
Exactly. And if we can just recognize that, and not only for ourselves, which is, that'd be a great thing to be able to recognize for myself that I am really in a classroom. And just like every other classroom I've ever been in my life, whether I wanted to be there or not, if I wanted to take the test or not, I wanted to study the lesson or not, doesn't matter. I'm still in the classroom, and I can either study and get the effects of it, of the learning, or I can reject it and be in and suffer and believe that things are going wrong. So that's my choice too, always. And
yep.
I may or may not choose peace. I may or may not choose life or joy or whatever, but that's my choice. And you know, if I it, and I get the effect, I always get the effect of whatever it is that I chose.
Right, right. But the effect has has done nothing to the reality that we all share. That's beyond our alleged dream reality, and that's that. I think that's a revelation that you know, we get glimpses of from time to time, and that awareness, I think, is what again we took with us into the dream, that suggests that no matter how crazy this world seems to be, and it does appear to be, you know, just rampantly insane at times. And, but I think if we look at it honestly, it's always the case. no matter how seemingly bizarre and perverse, and hateful and, you know, sinful, guilty, wicked, and all that kind of stuff, any adjectives we might want to heap on it, this world seems to represent, it's just, another variation in the dream of separation. And we can afford to gently smile at the choice in the mind, the choice in my mind. Each of us has to make that determination for ourselves, while we believe that we're separate selves, that has made up this dream. And then, and we can afford to, from that perspective, be infinitely kind and, choose to not have our peace compromised, and then that propagates in the minds of others, the alleged others that we come in contact with. So I'll, right. I'll read the second.
Before you do that, uh-huh. I was going to say, sure. You just when you said the alleged others, that's not just something to brush over. That's the actual truth. The alleged others are the entire population of the universe that appears to be outside of me. And, you know, when I come to know that there are no others, there is nothing outside of me, not me, the little body Lynn, but me, the being that I am, the Holy Son of God, then, all those others become aspects of my own thinking. Mm-hmm. And when I turn that inside out, when I turn that inside out and begin to see that even you right now, Bruce, who, you know, you're alive and well and speaking to me on Skype here, but in reality, everything I'm hearing, everything I'm seeing, everything I'm knowing about you in this conversation is in my own mind. Just as everything that you know about me in this conversation is in your own mind. There's nothing outside of my own mind. That doesn't negate your experience. But it makes my experience what I'm responsible for. And, my experience is where, you know, I decide, what I'm going to hear. I decide what I'm going to listen to. I decide how I'm going to react. It has nothing to do with you and anything. Even if you, you know, were coming up with a sword to chop my head off, you know, it's still my decision to see you as either the Holy Son of God or an evil being. And as long as I'm seeing you as the Holy Son of God, no matter what is happening, I'm at peace. And that's the key, is that I am at peace with what I see.
And that's
if
the
I'm
choice.
Not at peace, yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, and that, what you just said, that's the choice to what we broadcast out through our transmission apparatus in the mind at any given moment. And since all minds are joined, everyone is either picking up on the loving kindness of the peace that our inner kindness teacher represents, or its seeming opposite, which doesn't exist in truth, but only in dreams. And what you said a moment ago kind of reminded me of a favorite phrase in the early part of the text where he says, you know, I've taken all of your loving thoughts and kept them for you safe, and I'm paraphrasing greatly, and purified them of their errors. So the error, of course, is all the thoughts that we have that make a big deal out of differences. But the loving kindness that has been preserved is all the thoughts that we've had throughout eternity that relate to, the, in terms of our way of relating to them here, shared interests, but really the oneness that's behind that, that we can't really quite get our heads around, in truth, but, you know, in, well, in this alleged existence, but that is the truth of what we are, and that's what's preserved for us. That's what's kept safe and inviolate so that we don't have to concern ourselves with an identity that, that somehow has been compromised by the historical evidence that our senses have presented to us, and only it's really only the interpretation of our ego that has distorted those space-time experiences and made them into something that emphasizes the reality of differences.
Exactly. Yeah. And you don't even have to change the interpretation. All you have to know is it's an interpretation.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah, that's it. I don't have to reinterpret it and turn it into a happy dream or smiling children or anything like that. All I have to do is know it's an interpretation.
Yeah,
I'm making it up.
Yeah, and it's kind of analogous to that other favorite, another favorite metaphor of mine was the director's cuts on the DVD. You know, that the ego's interpretation is just one track that blathers on about, you know, an interpretation about reality, but we don't have to have that on. We don't have to identify with that as it, you know, we might still see it, you know, in little tiny letters, going across the bottom of the screen, but we can turn the volume down on it. And, you know, the closed caption will give us, you know, we can acknowledge it without denying that that's ego's interpretation as it comes in. But we can say, but I don't want to identify that with that. I don't choose to identify with the victimhood paradigm or the special love, special hate paradigm that makes differences real and in my mind only, and robs me of my peace. I can choose the other teacher, the real alternative.
Yes.
So I'll go ahead and read that second paragraph. A second major consideration is that a significant number of biblical scholars have concluded that very, very little is known about the historical Jesus. New Testament accounts of Jesus cannot be relied on for an accurate picture of his life and message. Because of this lack of, quote, objective, unquote, evidence, there is no way of evaluating the contradictory accounts of the historical Jesus. There is nothing to compare them against. In A Course in Miracles, Jesus refers to many biblical sayings and teachings attributed to him and tells us what he really meant and what he could not possibly have said. And I think that's corroborated not only in A Course in Miracles, where, you know, Gary Renard mentions how many times the Bible is quoted in the Course, and it's hundreds of times, maybe thousands. Anyway, it's a lot. And then I particularly enjoy Peirce's Gospel of Thomas, where in Gary's second book, Your Immortal Reality, that goes into you know, a correction of the sayings of Jesus, and it's really fascinating to read. I think my favorite of those corrected sayings, the corrected gospel quotes, is "be passersby." That's a really quick and easy one to remember, two-word quote, which suggests that if we can just kind of look at all the space-time stuff and see that, you know, ego's history and Holy Spirit's history are very different, we can afford to not be attached to the outcome of those historical events or their veracity of saying, well, this is the way things happen, because, you know, maybe there are parallel universes and realities that are countless in number that are made up for each seeming individual, that sure enough, the self-fulfilling prophecy works for each person's projections in a way that doesn't contradict the reality, but gives, according to ego's interpretation, This is how things are. And then someone else can say, no, this is how things are. And you've probably seen there's a really wonderful video that I found on one of my Facebook friends' posts that I shared probably more than once. it shows this sculpture of just what appears to be random objects in sort of kind of a haphazard array, just kind of piled in into this part of a room. And what you don't see until the camera slowly pans around in this sort of a circular arc is that at one point, and one point only, all those kind of funky, you know, misshapen and kind of, it looks like just a collection, a pile of junk, basically. When the camera hits just the right point, you see a face appear. And it's a, you know, a very, you know, artsy kind of stylized face, but there's an unmistakable face that appears. And then an instant later, the camera moves away from that location and you see the face disappear, you know, fairly quickly because the angle of the camera relative to each of those pieces is no longer there. And I think it's kind of like those magic eye posters where, you know, if you look beyond the surface image to something actually deeper than that, you can see a more dimensional image appear where just looking on the surface, it just may appear to just be random dots or shapes that don't have any particular meaning. And I think that's how, you know, we can metaphorically look at all the crazy things using this example, you know, that the historical quote unquote objective evidence of the person we call Jesus, you know, could very easily be another example of that, how we all see, and this FAQ points that out, we all see what we want to see, and it's our intention that then with the most important factor, in fact, one might say the only really important factor is which teaching, which thought system, which teacher are we bringing with us into that that moment, and that determines what we see.
Exactly. And you know, that means then that whatever it is that I think I see, I can change. I can shift.
Right.
You know, that it is the, you know, that this, you know, what is it that Jesus says? You know, the only problem is that you believe you are powerless.
Right.
And, you know, it's not true. I have all the power, you know, I'm completely in control of my whole reality, even though it appears that I'm a victim of it. And that's a part of my own making too. I figured it out.
Yeah. You know,
hey, Linda came in. Hi, sweetie. It is good to know that, I can see peace instead of this.
Yeah.
Huh. Anyway, go on and read. Yeah,
sure. Okay, I'll finish the last. Did I finish that paragraph? I think I did, didn't I?
Yes, you did.
Okay,
so
okay, I'll just finish the other one then. Lastly, also relevant to your interesting query is the course principle: all thinking produces form at some level, and that's from Chapter 2, Section 6, Paragraph 9, and Sentence 14. This is to say that for every thought, there is a corresponding reality. Thus, any thought of Jesus in any mind would have some expression in the world of quantum physics. There is nothing in the course about quantum physics, unfortunately, and so we must leave it at that.
Although the entire course, if you look at it from the viewpoint of quantum physics, the entire course is about it. So.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, and the beauty of quantum physics, you know, is that it basically brings us back to the mind, and I think that was the startling discovery that shook up the likes of Bohr and Planck and Einstein and Heisenberg and all those luminaries in that era just a few decades ago, when they realized that they could no longer discount mind as a primary aspect or attribute of reality, because of the you know, the double slit experiment and the fact that, you know, it, depending on the expectations of the observer, the outcome can be different, and that's that's a validation which has been repeated countless times in the laboratory, that mind is primary, not just some little side variable thrown into the equation, and and a fudge factor kind of a thing. No, it's primary. It's a very crucial aspect to reality. In fact, most physicists probably wouldn't go there, but you know, I think that's where A Course in Miracles and other non-dual metaphysics systems go beyond where physics can go because of the different premise is that, you know, one could say that mind is the only thing that exists and matter, including all of space-time and every all of the countless myriad of forms that we appear to experience, are just hallucinations that we ascribe meaning to. And, you know, like those early workbook lessons, we've given it all the meaning that they have for us.
Excuse me. So, you know, as you go on through your life and experience, for me anyway, I've really begun to see how that works, and the results of my own thinking have astounded me, actually, that I really could think, excuse me, the way that I appeared to be thinking, and that all I had to do was shift, and like you said with that picture, you move to another perspective, and all of a sudden it becomes something completely different. And it is, you know, this is how my experience has been, is that in the shift of perspective, I see the perfection of everything, whereas if I shift just a little bit to the right or the left, you know, it appears to be chaos. And there is only one point of view at which that entire picture coalesces to be that man's face or that whatever it is. Mm-hmm. Only one place where that actually exists. And the rest of it is just a chaotic assemblage of stuff.
Yeah.
So I love that picture, and I love that, you know, that I've seen that many times, and that sculpture. Uh-huh. And I think that artist made several others of the same ilk. You know, and I see it happening